The blowback from this will be a separation of the thinking people from the mindless idiots in society, and an increase in social distrust and hostility towards politicians and media and government institutions. This is fermenting instability and the destruction of personal civil liberties through manufactured national hysteria.
Hello everybody, Julian Charles here of themindrenewed.com, coming to you as usual from the depths of the Lancashire countryside here in the UK. And welcome to another one of my slightly unusual productions during this time in which I'm involved in a couple of house moves. The first one is over, that of my parents, but in a few days from now, we're going to be experiencing our own uprooting as our belongings are packed onto the removals lorry and shifted just a few miles down the road, actually, to be next door to my parents, which is quite an amazing thing to have worked out. Which means, of course, we're going to be able to help them out in various ways much more easily than before. And my mum and dad will be able to see more of their grandchildren than ever before. So a blessing in many ways. And indeed, and you will expect me to say this, and I believe it, a providential turn of events. So as I've said before, during this time, I'm using the opportunity to do some different things. The first was the house move diary last time. And if you haven't heard that, of course, I recommend go and listen to that. A lot of people have contacted me to say how much they enjoyed that. So thank you to all of you who did that. That's very encouraging. This is the second of those rather unusual podcasts. A sharing of a very interesting conversation between Martin Summers and Tony Gosling on the politics show of BCFM Radio. That's Bristol Community FM, and that show can be found at bcfmradio.com/politics. A conversation that was broadcast just over a week ago, on the 16th of March 2018, discussing the Sergei Skripal affair in Salisbury, UK, on the 4th of March, and the subsequent political fallout of that event, followed by a chat that I had then with Tony Gosling a few days later, on Wednesday evening, late at night, to basically add more background to that story, Tony having worked as a BBC reporter in the past in that very area of Salisbury, and to explore some of the persistent and really very serious questions that surround that whole, I think, highly suspicious story. And the reason why I'm doing this is because, like, I should think the vast majority of you listening to TMR, I felt deeply insulted by the mainstream media coverage of that event and many of the statements coming from the British government. In fact, as I said to Tony before we recorded our chat, I have quite similar feelings about this as I did 7 years ago about the whole Osama bin Laden assassination story. I found that story so absurd, and I still do, that I felt deeply insulted that anyone should expect me to believe it. And I feel much the same about this. To my mind, it makes no sense that Vladimir Putin should have ordered this to take place. There are a million and one ways to kill a person, so I'm informed. Some of them are very difficult to trace back to the perpetrator. If Putin wanted to kill Sergei Skripal, first, he could have done it while Skripal was in custody in Russia. Second, he could have done it in a quiet way that wouldn't lead to international outrage. Third, he surely wouldn't have used a red flag chemical weapon on British soil, which of course plays directly into the weapons of mass destruction meme that's been so pressed against Assad. If he did it, he would certainly have done it in such a way as not to give his geopolitical opponents the opportunity to whip up fear and score propaganda victories against him. I think to believe that he did it, I think you have to believe that Putin is mad or that he's stupid. And I don't think he's either. I see no evidence of this. I mean, I'm sure that he's as hard as nails and I wouldn't want to cross him, but I don't think he's mad or stupid. And, you know, as to the explanation that I've heard that this is some kind of warning to would-be traitors, you know, don't betray us or you'll die. I mean, if you work for intelligence agencies, surely you don't need a warning like that. I mean, you know the score already. You sell secrets, you may well end up in a place that you don't want to end up. So I find the immediate pinning of this on Russia insulting. Obviously to the Russians it's insulting, but I mean to me as a consumer of media. So I wanted to respond to this in some way, but the time limitations being such as they are, I thought, well, I can't schedule an interview. So I decided to find some good resource to share, as I do from time to time. And I found it in this conversation that I'm going to play today. But of course, that then led to an interview anyway, unplanned, indeed unprepared for, but an interview nonetheless. So here they are. First, Martin Summers and Tony Gosling in discussion on BCFM radio, followed by my late night chat with Tony a few days later. And let me say, as I always do, the fact that I'm playing this does not mean that I necessarily agree with every word that is said. That's not the point. The point is, this is investigative journalism, which we witness all too rarely these days, asking real questions that do need to be raised.
So, Martin, for you, what's the biggest thing about this Sergei Skripal spy scandal story?
Well, I think what's very clear is that it ought to be obvious to everybody that one of the suspects in this case must be the Western intelligence services or other third-party intelligence services, for example, the Ukrainian intelligence service. And the fact that it's the Russians have been, convicted and tried and convicted and made guilty all in the space of 48 hours ought to raise questions in everybody's mind. How can the British state establish all of these facts in that sort of time scale? And they can't really. And to my mind, this fits a pattern of Western intelligence service provocation, which we can discuss at some length if we've got time. But the fact is that in the past, Western intelligence services have engaged in exactly this kind of provocation. So, for example, I'll just make one point. The anthrax, which was circulated inside the United States after the 9/11 attacks, it's very, very clear, and anybody can check this online, the anthrax was all traced back to Fort Detrick in Maryland, which is the US equivalent of Porton Down. So it definitely came from inside the structure, no doubt about it.
But can chemical weapons be traced back in the same way as biological weapons can?
Well, I don't know, and we're all waiting to hear where the things I've been reading suggest that, and of course what the Russians said quite rightly is, well, you send us a sample of what you've discovered and we will cooperate with your investigation, because in fact we're as angry about this as you are. We don't want this sort of thing happening. We didn't write it off, sign it off. We didn't do it. We want to get to the bottom of it. And there are mechanisms for getting to the bottom of it. I mean, in about 2 years ago, there was celebrations in Russia because they'd got rid of their whole chemical warfare stockpile. And that was, they were given a clean
bill. Can we trust them?
Well, no, not necessarily. But the point is that was an internationally supervised deal whereby the Russians agreed to get rid of their chemical warfare stockpile, and we agreed to get rid of ours. And as a result of this particular incident, we're now going to get a massive increase in expenditure and infrastructure at Porton Down. And I have to ask the question, and somebody ought to ask it as a parliamentary question or a freedom of information question, the decision to expand Porton Down, which has been pushed forward on the back of this.
It's £48 million is suddenly descending on Porton.
Yes, indeed. And was that all decided since this incident, or was it already in the pipeline before the incident?
See, there's a bit of
and
a
does
problem.
It have something to do with the incident?
Well, I would suggest yes, it does.
I think Sherlock Holmes, you might be right there.
Porton Down is saying nothing really about the origin of this. In fact, what Craig Murray, the former ambassador, is saying, his contacts in the Foreign Office, he says, he's now received confirmation from a well-placed Foreign and Commonwealth Office source that Porton Down scientists are not able to identify the nerve agent as being of Russian manufacture and have been resentful of the pressure being placed on them to do so. Porton Down would only sign up to a formulation of a type originally developed by Russia. So that's what... is this a bribe, this £48 million, to get the Porton Down people to play ball?
If we just do a thought experiment for a minute, if this is a Western intelligence service come on, which I suspect it may be, now there's a possibility that a group like the Ukrainians may have their fingers. Don't forget, they used to be part of the Soviet Union as well. And of course, Craig Murray used to be British ambassador to Uzbekistan, and that was where the equivalent of Porton Down in the Soviet Union was located. And it was all dismantled during the Yeltsin era by Western scientists from the US and elsewhere, and they took away everything that was there. So what the British have got to do if they want to make this stick is they've got to make the whatever they found available to others to try and ascertain
Listen,
where it
Martin,
came from.
It's already sticking and it's stuck, really, because Trump and Macron and the EU effectively have all come in on Britain's side, this saying, you're absolutely right, expel those diplomats.
Yes, and so have some right-wing Labour MPs, but I'd say none of them have any evidence to prove it one way or the other. All we've got is the word of the British government and the word of the British intelligence services, who've got a track record going back to the 1940s of behaving in a provocative fashion. And as I just mentioned, just as a for instance, the anthrax attacks in the US, which killed six people after 9/11, definitely came from Fort Detrick, definitely came from inside the structure. No one inside the structure was ever punished.
Therefore, we can
presume they carry on doing the same sorts of things.
This Novichok weapon, apparently, is it likely to have actually been at Porton Down, which is only 10 minutes drive away? Let me finish the sentence, which is only 10 minutes drive away from Salisbury. Is Novichok likely to have been at Porton Down?
Well, what the Russians are saying is the only way they could have ascertained that it was Novichok is if they've got samples of their own to compare it against. And, of course, the Russian chemical warfare capability was comprehensively dismantled during the Yeltsin era, and virtually all of it was brought back to the West. And as I've just pointed out, the Russians agreed to dismantle their chemical warfare stuff. It was all dismantled according
Apparently
to international...
Apparently it's been destroyed, the chemical weapons from Russia.
Yeah, but, of course, ours hasn't been. Porton Down hasn't been dismantled, has it?
And neither has the United States. The programme of destruction of US chemical weapons has still 5 years to run.
Yes, well, the Russians got ahead of the game and got rid of them all. Because the point is, for the Russians, that what they've been concentrating on is developing fourth-generation nuclear weapons. The stuff that really matters.
So, in other words, because chemical weapons maybe can't be used to take out military targets, they're much more dangerous to civilians?
No, I think what's...
Anything to do with it? Well, because the Russian weaponry seems to be that was revealed the other week, these nuclear-powered cruise missiles. I mean, these are there to take out hard targets.
Well, they're there to take out any target you like. I mean, let's face it, a nuclear bomb is not very discriminating. The point about chemical weapons is there's this whole trope of weapons of mass destruction. We all know the phrase weapons of mass destruction. Now, the reason that was pushed in the run-up to the First and Second Gulf Wars is because it blurs the line between nuclear weapons, which are nuclear, and conventional weapons. Chemical warfare is effectively just enhanced conventional warfare. You can kill quite a lot of people with chemical weapons, but not that many. They were found to be pretty useless in the First World War. They didn't work that well. And they're not comparable with nuclear weapons. They're just not. But by using the phrase weapons of mass destruction, you make them sound as if they are. And of course,
a chemical weapon could kill millions of people.
In theory.
Surely a bullet can't do that.
Biological
weapons could effectively, I mean, if it was the right kind of thing, could kill the entire population of the planet.
Well, I mean, I'm quite sure that the Iranians have still got a biological chemical warfare program because they haven't got nuclear weapons.
Biological weapons are much more indiscriminate. Anyway, also Israel has extensive stocks of chemical weapons, but has also always refused to declare any of them to the chemical weapons regulators. They're not a state party to the Chemical Weapons Convention, nor a member of the OPCW. So Israel signed in 1993, but refused to ratify, as this would mean inspection and destruction of the chemical weapons of Israel.
Well, I mean, if I was a Wiltshire police officer, I would suggest that the Israelis are one of the suspects in this case, because they've been their policy in Syria has been completely frustrated by Putin and the Russians, and they've got a vested interest in stirring trouble between the Britain and Russia. And of course, just think of it from take another step back. The Russians are just about to have a presidential election, and in another universe, they would be congratulated for having the third relatively free election in their history after hundreds of years of authoritarianism. But instead of being congratulated, they're being vilified. And of course, Putin is going to win. He's going to win handsomely because he's got a lot of popular support.
I mean, they're saying that this is an attempt to interfere in the Russian elections.
Yes, I mean, that's how it's perceived in Russia.
And
because they know that Putin's going to win. Putin's going to win, which is very embarrassing for the West.
The death of Nikolai Glushkov as well, who was a friend of Boris Berezovsky. Now, we'll talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, let's go back to that. Yeah.
Glushkov was actually involved very much in working for Berezovsky at Aeroflot.
Yeah.
Now, Aeroflot is absolutely key to understanding this competition between Putin and Berezovsky, because once Putin got into power, he thought he was going to be Berezovsky thought Putin was going to be his little puppet, would do what he wanted. But he revived this old Aeroflot case. Now, think about who these oligarchs are. Berezovsky was running the NTV channel, the biggest channel in Russia, private channel in Russia.
It was like a Berlusconi figure.
And also running Aeroflot. So this is where what was happening was the whole of the nation under Yeltsin, the drunken president, was being asset stripped. Berezovsky was one of the oligarchs that was doing that asset stripping. He was asset stripping the national airline. Mm-hmm. And once Putin got into power, he revived this old case and said, actually, Berezovsky, you've got some questions to answer about what happened to our national airline.
Yeah.
And then Berezovsky had to flee the country and came to London. Now, this guy who's been found dead is someone that knew all about what had happened there.
Yeah, well, Berezovsky himself, of course, was found dead in his Surrey mansion some years ago, and the local coroner wouldn't write it, suggest it was a suicide.
It does make you wonder, doesn't it, if these people knew that they've been killed by someone that didn't want what they knew to come out to the public.
Yes, what you've got to remember is that these opposition figures to Putin, like this chap and Berezovsky...
Nikolai Grishkov, just remind you of his name.
And Khodorkovsky, who was sent to prison and then released, these people are big style criminals. They're gangsters. And the idea that Russia is an oligarchic state, in a sense, is true. But what Putin has done is he's disciplined the oligarchy, particularly the oligarchs of Jewish origin, many of whom have Israeli joint citizenship, and were basically at one stage pulling Russia into Israel's orbit.
So the most, shall we say, draconian or ruthless element of the Russian mafia are in London, and some of them are actually funding the Conservative Party.
Well, the point. And they're also opposed to Putin. Yeah, that's why they're in London. Berezovsky was getting more and more frustrated because, of course, he couldn't get the West to back him. He tried
close relationship with the Duke of Kent, didn't he?
Yes,
the Queen's cousin, who's also
now.
The
don't
head
forget
of
that these people
the
are these people are quite capable of murdering each other in order to make Russia look bad. I know many people listening will say, "Well, that's a preposterous idea," but it's not. If you knew anything about Russia in the Bespredel era, as they called it, the without rules era, you will realise that all of these people are very, very gangsterish, and they're quite capable of killing each other over various disputes that they've got with each other.
It's handy in a way that this guy's no longer around, because it makes it more difficult to dig up all this stuff about what happened with the privatisation of Aeroflot, the asset stripping of Russia under Yeltsin.
Well, I mean, don't forget, this guy's 68 and he's died of a heart attack, so it's not necessarily the case that anybody murdered him at all. Berezovsky, on the other hand, was strangled. Now, they're saying that the police are now saying that there's evidence of compression on his neck. Okay, but that still doesn't mean the Russian state has done this. These people are gangsters. They've got enemies. And, of course, what may be happening here is we're having an intelligence. Don't forget, you've got to see this in the context of all the lies that have been told by the Western intelligence services about Russian policy over the last 5 years. The coup in Ukraine, where the shooters that shot the Maidan Square demonstrators, has just come out in a court case in Kiev that was definitely not carried out by the then regime of Yanukovych. It was carried out by the new regime with the mercenaries from Georgia who were actually given instructions by US military personnel, and that all came out in the court case in Kiev.
Ratsani was mentioning the coup in Ukraine actually on BBC Question Time last night and getting sort of a lot of pilloried, as actually Jeremy Corbyn was. He was getting pilloried for questioning what the government are doing over this Russian Salisbury case.
Then you can see what the motivation is for Western intelligence services to carry out this scam. It puts Corbyn on the back foot. It means that we can ask for more money for military industrial complex, 48 million more for Pelton Down. It pulls Britain into line with Trump. And of course, I'm quite sure that will be the assessment of the Russian intelligence services of what's going on here. They will know whether they were involved or not. Think, why would the Russian intelligence services, when they're just about to have a successful national election in which Putin is going to win, come to Britain and kill somebody and make it look as if they did it so that they can get the blame?
Okay,
that's pretty silly, isn't it?
So what you're saying is a psychological warfare. Let's have a listen now to one of the initial statements by Theresa May about this whole business and the reaction by former psychological warfare officer in the US Army, Scott Bennett.
It is now clear that Mr. Skripal and his daughter were poisoned with a military-grade nerve agent of a type developed by Russia. This is part of a group of nerve agents known as Novichok. Based on the positive identification of this chemical agent by world-leading experts at the Defence Science and Technology Laboratory at Porton Down, our knowledge that Russia has previously produced this agent and would still be capable of doing so, Russia's record of conducting state-sponsored assassinations, and our assessment that Russia views some defectors as legitimate targets for assassinations, the government has concluded that it is highly likely that Russia was responsible for the act against Sergei and Yulia Skripal.
I think this was orchestrated by the UK government, possibly using other assets and CIA or Mossad, because Russia certainly doesn't gain from anything like this. And to summon the Russians and say, answer which of these two is correct, either you did this against us or someone else got your material and did this, the Russians need to say, no, there's a third option, and that is that the United Kingdom has designed a psychological operation to manipulate its own public to distract the United Kingdom away from the MI6 Christopher Steele agent that wrote a false Russian dossier to undermine Donald Trump and the British role in that, as well as the British role in the al-Nusra chemical weapons that has just come out, which Russia and Syria have said all along has nothing to do with Syria or Russia, but everything to do with the United Kingdom and the United States.
Now, what's he talking about there? Because I wasn't aware about this business of the British in some way being involved and the Americans maybe being involved in chemical weapons in Syria too.
Well, that's a very key point.
Al-Nusra.
The al-Nusra Front, if it was Seymour Hersh, I mean, Scott Bennett's a former psychological warfare officer, but Seymour Hersh is a senior US journalist, if not the senior US journalist, got several Pulitzer Prizes and so on. He was the one who exposed the My Lai massacre. He wrote an article about the chemical weapons attack in Ghouta some years ago, which was blamed on the Assad government. And he pointed out that it wasn't only not the Assad government that carried it out, it was carried out by the al-Nusra Front, which is al-Qaeda, but that the sarin used for the attack came from Libya and had been supplied to al-Nusra by Western intelligence services. So not only are the Russians not guilty in Syria, we are the guilty parties. And when Obama was saying there's a red line here if people use chemical weapons against their own people or people in general, it's actually Western intelligence services who are the guilty party here. And the White Helmets, who have been the source of much of this scurrilous information, are funded by the British taxpayer to the tune of millions of pounds. We've got people sleeping on the streets, but we've got people running around in Syria doing PR for al-Qaeda as part of MI6. And as I said in the first hour, MI6 in places like the Middle East is not regarded as some kind of benevolent organisation.
Okay,
it's actually regarded as extremely tricky, ruthless and not very pleasant.
Lover or hater, Prime Minister Theresa May made a statement on Wednesday all about this, and this is about 4 minutes long, but we're going to have a listen now to what she had to say, and I'll ask you to comment afterwards, Martin, about the so-called Russian assassins of Salisbury.
There is no alternative conclusion other than that the Russian state was culpable for the attempted murder of Mr. Skripal and his daughter, and for threatening the lives of other British citizens in Salisbury, including Detective Sergeant Nick Bailey. This represents an unlawful use of force by the Russian state against the United Kingdom. And as I set out on Monday, it has taken place against the backdrop of a well-established pattern of Russian state aggression across Europe and beyond. It must therefore be met with a full and robust response beyond the actions we have already taken since the murder of Mr. Litvinenko, and to counter this pattern of Russian aggression elsewhere. As the discussion in this House on Monday made clear, it is essential that we now come together with our allies to defend our security, to stand up for our values, and to send a clear message to those who would seek to undermine them. This morning I chaired a further meeting of the National Security Council, where we agreed immediate actions to dismantle the Russian espionage network in the UK, urgent work to develop new powers to tackle all forms of hostile state activity, and to ensure that those seeking to carry out such activity cannot enter the UK, and additional steps to suspend all planned high-level contacts between the United Kingdom and the Russian Federation. Let me start with the immediate actions. Mr. Speaker, the House will recall that following the murder of Mr. Litvinenko, the UK expelled 4 diplomats. Under the Vienna Convention, the United Kingdom will now expel 23 Russian diplomats who have been identified as undeclared intelligence officers. They have just 1 week to leave. This will be the single biggest expulsion for over 30 years, and it reflects the fact that this is not the first time that the Russian state has acted against our country. Through these expulsions, we will fundamentally degrade Russian intelligence capability in the UK for years to come. And if they seek to rebuild it, we will prevent them from doing so. Second, we will urgently develop proposals for new legislative powers to harden our defences against all forms of hostile state activity. This will include the addition of a targeted power to detain those suspected of hostile state activity at the UK border. This power is currently only permitted in relation to those suspected of terrorism. And I have asked the Home Secretary to consider whether there is a need for new counter-espionage powers to clamp down on the full spectrum of hostile activities of foreign agents in our country. Mr. Speaker, as I set out on Monday, we will also table a government amendment to the sanctions bill to strengthen our powers to impose sanctions in response to the violation of human rights. In doing so, we will play our part in an international effort to punish those responsible for the sorts of abuses suffered by Sergei Magnitsky. Yeah. And I hope, as with all the measures I am setting out today, that this will command cross-party support. Mr. Speaker, we will also make full use of existing powers to enhance our efforts to monitor and track the intentions of those travelling to the UK who could be engaged in activity that threatens the security of the UK and of our allies. So we will increase checks on private flights, customs and freight. We will freeze Russian state assets wherever we have the evidence that they may be used to threaten the life or property of UK nationals or residents. And led by the National Crime Agency, we will continue to bring all the capabilities of UK law enforcement to bear against serious criminals and corrupt elites. There is no place for these people or their money in our country. Mr. Speaker, let me be clear. While our response must be robust, it must also remain true to our values as a liberal democracy that believes in the rule of law. Many Russians have made this country their home, abide by our laws, and make an important contribution to our country, which we must continue to welcome. But to those who seek to do us harm, my message is simple. You are not welcome here.
Unlike the Saudis, of course, of whom the red carpet will be rolled out.
Well, it was, wasn't it, last
indeed,
week?
Even though we know that various people were tortured to death by Mohammed bin Salman
and also
in
we,
the previous weeks before he arrived. Anyway, that's
well,
a bit of whataboutery.
But it isn't, because also we know that they are the main funders of Islamic extremism in Britain.
Indeed, that's right, because there was a government report that showed they were the main funders of extremist madrasas in the country, and therefore we're not allowed to hear that because that would upset the government.
So one thing that strikes me about what she's saying there is these are very extreme measures for something which hasn't... It's a rush to judgment, it seems to me.
Well, it's, yes. I mean, the point I would make about this is, where is the evidence that the Russian state was involved
in? Well, she'll say, we can't tell you because it's national security.
Well, I would say that that's not good enough, especially when we've got evidence going back decades of Western intelligence services engaging in this kind of provocation. And I'll mention him for the umpteenth time, Fernando Imposimato, the head of the Italian Supreme Court, who died last year. He uncovered the fact that the Western intelligence services were involved in terrorism, and including provocational terrorism, like kidnapping the Prime Minister and pretending that it was being done by the Red Brigades and then killing the Prime Minister. That was done by NATO intelligence services, by MI6. And if they can do that, they can kill a couple of people who are Russian nobodies who crossed the line in Salisbury, although they haven't died yet.
She also mentions Litvinenko there. How is that connected with
Listen, the Litvinenko case, the Russians have always maintained that they didn't kill him as well.
Because he was a Russian agent, but he also wrote a book, didn't he?
Yeah, well,
he wrote a book, Blowing Up Russia.
He wrote a book called Blowing Up Russia. And of course, in that book, which I'm quite sure Theresa May hasn't read, Litvinenko said that Putin and others that are running Russia are involved in the Moscow and Ryazan apartment bombs of 999, September 1999, when hundreds of people were killed by these no warning bombs, supposedly by the Chechens, but in actual fact carried out by the FSB as a means of consolidating the power of Boris Yeltsin in his second term, when Putin was the prime minister. And of course, what's interesting about the books is Litvinenko says, I know this happened because I and my boss Berezovsky were involved in these bombings with Putin, and therefore Putin's guilty. And at the same time, these people were given asylum in Britain because they were used as a mechanism for getting back at Putin once Putin had double-crossed the CIA and MI6. But, of course, all of these people are expendable. When the police investigated the Litvinenko case, they found polonium everywhere. I mean, if you're going to kill somebody, I mean, Chavez was probably murdered by the US, but he died of very, very rare cancer.
It seems to me that Litvinenko,
which nobody could pin on them,
was simply the man who knew too much.
Yeah, that's right.
And therefore, the idea that he might actually start to talk about the possibility of who might have been criticised Berezovsky, for example.
Yeah, I would suggest if I was a police officer investigating that, I would suggest that Berezovsky was the prime suspect because he was getting desperate, and Berezovsky was pushing the idea that we've got to start using this against Putin. The Moscow bombs, we were involved in it. We know he was involved in it. Let's wind one. And of course, the Western powers basically are saying to Berezovsky, we can't start accusing Putin of bombing Moscow.
That would bring the cat out of the bag.
Because that let the cat out of the bag for what we did at Bologna, what we did at 9/11 and all the rest of it. And 7/7. Basically, virtually all of these incidents are, in fact, intelligence service come-ons. But they're not by the Russian intelligence services, as I said on Russia Today the other week. The real scandal here is not that the Russians have been interfering in Western elections and trying to steer things. It's that the Western intelligence services are interfering. Look at the way this has played out. Within 24 hours, the whole raft of what the military-industrial complex wanted in the West has just been passed NEMCON on the back of an incident where it's not even been proved that there was any nerve agent. We've only got the government. They won't provide the nerve agent. It could be that the whole thing is just theatre. That's a possibility.
Okay, so let's have a listen to the... I mean, that wasn't all Theresa May had to say. There were some more measures that she talked about. This is a lot shorter, this bit, but I'm going to hear from you again after this, Martin.
Mr Speaker, let me turn to our bilateral relationship. As I said on Monday, we have had a very simple approach to Russia. Engage, but beware. And I continue to believe it is not in our national interest to break off all dialogue between the United Kingdom and the Russian Federation. But in the aftermath of this appalling act against our country, this relationship cannot be the same. So we will suspend all planned high-level bilateral contacts between the United Kingdom and the Russian Federation. This includes revoking the invitation to Foreign Minister Lavrov to pay a reciprocal visit to the UK, and confirming there will be no attendance by ministers or indeed members of the royal family at this summer's World Cup in Russia. Finally, Mr Speaker, we will deploy a range of tools from across the full breadth of our national security apparatus in order to counter the threats of hostile state activity. While I have set out some of these measures today, members on all sides will understand that there are some that cannot be shared publicly for reasons of national security. And, of course, there are other measures we stand ready to deploy at any time should we face further Russian provocation. Mr Speaker, none of the actions we take are intended to damage legitimate activity or prevent contacts between our populations. We have no disagreement with the people of Russia, who have been responsible for so many great achievements throughout their history. Many of us looked at a post-Soviet Russia with hope. We wanted a better relationship. And it is tragic that President Putin has chosen to act in this way. But we will not tolerate the threat to life of British people and others on British soil from the Russian government, nor will we tolerate such a flagrant breach of Russia's international obligations.
Well, it's just sickening, really, to hear this hypocritical tirade.
So does she think, has she got definite evidence that it happened or not? Because she's saying both things. She's saying, we think this that Putin was behind it. And then she's saying also that he definitely was behind it at the same time.
Well, in other words, they haven't basically got any evidence that they're prepared to share with us. So we're entitled to presume that they may be lying. And the idea that the British government doesn't lie about stuff like this, in Bologna, where they were bombed, in West Belfast, where they were bombed by the British, in Syria, where the chemical weapons attack was carried out with the aid and support of Western intelligence services, including our own, they would laugh a hollow laugh.
I mean, you can hear her turning the pages there. Who writes these speeches for us? You're just reading this off.
Yeah, they're written by the securocrats who run this country. And of course, the securocrats who run this country, Dear Love, who used to head MI6, was quoted in the Telegraph or the Times the other week saying, well, Corbyn's unfit to be Prime Minister. He wouldn't pass a vetting. So somebody who used to be the head of our intelligence services presumes to decide who can and can't be Prime Minister. And that's because they have far too much power.
Anyway,
they've always had far too much power.
Anyway, let's have a listen now to Jeremy Corbyn, leader of the opposition Labour Party, his response to Theresa May's statement on this.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I would like to thank the Prime Minister for advanced sight of her statement and echo absolutely her words about the service of our emergency and public services. The attack in Salisbury was an appalling act of violence. Nerve agents are abominable if used in any war. It is utterly reckless to use them in a civilian environment. This attack in Britain has concerned our allies in the European Union, NATO and the UN, and their words of solidarity have strengthened our position diplomatically. Our response as a country must be guided by the rule of law, support for international agreements and respect for human rights. So when it comes to the use of chemical weapons on British soil, it is essential that the government works with the United Nations to strengthen its chemical weapons monitoring system and involves the Office of the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons. The Prime Minister said on Monday, either this was a direct act by the Russian state or the Russian government lost control of their potentially catastrophically damaging nerve agent and allowed it to get in the hands of others. Our response must be both decisive and proportionate and based on clear evidence. If the government believes that it is still a possibility that Russia negligently lost control of a military-grade nerve agent, what action is being taken through the OPCW with our allies? I welcome the fact the police are working with the OPCW. And has the Prime Minister taken the necessary steps under the Chemical Weapons Convention to make a formal request for evidence from the Russian government under Article 9.2? How has she responded to the Russian government's request for a sample of the agent used in the Salisbury attack to run its own tests? Has high-resolution trace analysis been run on a sample of the nerve agent, and has that revealed any evidence as to the location of its production or the identity of its perpetrators? And can the Prime Minister update the House on what conversations, if any, she has had with the Russian government? And while suspending planned high-level contacts, does the Prime Minister agree that it is essential to maintain a robust dialogue with Russia in the interests of our own and wider international security? With many countries, Mr. Speaker, speaking out alongside us, the circumstances demand that we build an international consensus to address the use of chemical weapons. We should urge our international allies to join us and call on Russia to reveal without delay full details of its chemical weapons program to the Organisation for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons. It is, as we on these benches have expressed before, a matter of huge regret that our country's diplomatic capacity has been stripped back with cuts of 25% in the last 5 years. It is, Mr. Speaker. It is, Mr. Speaker.
The Right Honourable Gentleman must be heard. There will be adequate opportunity for colleagues on both sides of the House to put questions. Members must be heard. Jeremy Corbyn.
I couldn't understand a word of what the Foreign Secretary just said, Mr. Speaker, but his behaviour demeans his office.
Yeah.
It is in moments such as these that governments realise how vital strong diplomacy and political pressure are for our security and national interest. The measures we take have to be effective, not just for the long-term security of our citizens, but to secure a world free of chemical weapons.
Now, the obvious question here is, these conventions, surely a sample of this, should be sent either to the Chemical Weapons International Body or to the Russians. And the Russians could say, actually, we know where this came from or whatever.
Well, the Russians, that's exactly what the Russians said. There is a procedure to follow here. We're perfectly happy to cooperate because we don't want people being killed by this stuff. Don't forget that the Russians were adjudicated to have got rid of their chemical weapons stockpile under agreements that were made during the Yeltsin era, and they were given a certificate. There was actually a big party in Russia where they said we finally got rid of our chemical weapons. And don't forget, it was Putin who put pressure on Assad to get rid of his chemical weapons. Now, it's possible that somewhere they're hiding some, but we're not hiding ours. We're actually expanding our chemical weapons facility at Porton Down. We're spending another £48 million quid on it. And of course, it does beg a belief.
Okay, well, a World Cup. She talked about that as well.
Well, I mean, one of my friends was suggesting that if these bigwigs don't want to go to the World Cup, we should have a lottery to have free tickets for those who do want to go.
Are we going to see ultimately a boycott of the World Cup?
Well, I mean, the Russians may turn around and say the only team that's not going to be allowed to come here is the English team, and you can suck on that.
But I mean, would that be a good?
I don't think they will do that. But
I mean,
they could.
That would just alienate the population.
Well, exactly.
Here,
and I think that if I was the Russians, I wouldn't even expel British diplomats at this stage. But the problem is that you've got public opinion in Russia. Public opinion in Russia is that they're being scapegoated. They feel that they never get a fair crack of the whip and that everything they do is wrong. It doesn't matter how they behave. They're always going to be accused of, give a dog a bad name and they'll stick to it.
The most recent, I suppose, on this is the Defence Secretary yesterday here in Bristol, up at Rolls-Royce, talking about this. That is to say, before he was an MP, he used to sell fireplaces. He's Gavin Williamson.
Yes. Oh.
What we will do is we will look at how Russia responds to what we have done. It is absolutely atrocious and outrageous what Russia did in Salisbury. We have responded to that. Frankly, Russia should go away, it should shut up. But if they do respond to the action that we've taken, we'll consider it carefully and we'll look at our options. But it would be wrong to prejudge their response. There is no doubt where this attack came from. It came from Russia. It is time for the whole country to unite behind the Prime Minister. Give her our full support. Make it clear as a nation that we stand together. That is what I believe when you sit in the House of Commons and you listen to members of Parliament from all parties on the backbenches. That is what they're wanting to see. Britain standing together against this great threat. That is what we will do. That is the support that we'll offer the Prime Minister. That is what the nation wants to see us doing from all parties.
Now, on Twitter, somebody described him as a sort of sinister version of Frank Spencer. But what he's saying there, this whole idea of go away and shut up, it doesn't sound like very diplomatic language.
Well, also, they're saying we think the Russians did it, but then that's elided into they definitely did do it. Now, in actual fact, it's not proven that they did. And, of course, they are saying
what they're doing is conflating fact and speculation.
Yes. And, of course, they're also trying to bully people into line in Parliament. If you criticise us or whatever, then you're somehow a traitor or whatever. Now, the obvious thing for the Russians to do, if they really want to hurt us, is turn around to BP and say, right, you've got to get out of our oil fields. Just go.
And is that going to happen?
No. Because what the Russians want is actually, and I've said this on RT, I'm a regular contributor on RT, as you know, Tony.
They've also talked about revoking their licence.
Yeah, but because what they said to that is, well, we'll just revoke BBC licence inside Russia. Everybody can go down this tit-for-tat road, and it's not...
And is that likely to end in war?
Well, it could do. It could easily do, because basically the RAF are overflying Syria at the moment with drones run from RAF Waddington, and they're killing Russian military personnel.
Now, in the background to all of this, you've got to ask yourself, why would anyone want war? And it was fascinating speaking to Bruce Gagnon, and you can hear this on Dialect next Tuesday at noon here on BCFM. He's a campaigner against space weapons and nuclear power in space, and what he was explaining to me was that the real fear in the US military is that the Chinese and the Russians are catching up with the ability to destroy satellites in space. And so we're kind of back at the old Cuban Missile crisis stage in the 1960s, where we had the missile gap and that the Russians were catching up with the Americans. And so the military was saying, well, look, if we can have some sort of conflict now, we can actually deny space to the Chinese and to the Russians. But we need to do it now because they're catching up.
All right. Well, there's quite a lot to unpack there. There wasn't a missile gap, in fact. It was a come on by the military-industrial complex. The fact of the matter is there's mutually assured destruction is still there. That's what Putin's speech was about the other week. They've been pushing missiles into Romania and Poland, which are effectively first-strike missiles. When the Russians tried to do a similar thing in Cuba, they went nuts. But they're being asked to tolerate that being pushed in their faces. The Russians actually, before this incident, said that they had evidence that there was going to be another chemical weapons false flag inside eastern Ghouta, and that then that was going to be used as an excuse for a military strike by NATO powers on the Syrian military. And they said, don't do that, because we will shoot your planes down. Now, without anybody wanting war, it could break out. And don't forget that Hillary Benn, who was a shadow foreign secretary at the time, he was pushing for us to go to war over the Ghouta chemical weapons attack, which Simon Hirsch, I think, pretty comprehensively shown, was carried out by the Al-Nusra Front in league with White Helmets, who are all working for NATO intelligence. So in actual fact...
What about this idea of
NATO using chemical weapons as part of provocation.
What I'm talking about is this whole thing in space, because this is concerning. If the US military just this week have announced, Donald Trump has announced, he wants a space force, which is like the Air Force in space, which I imagine is there to destroy Russian satellites and Chinese satellites.
Yeah, but the thing is, the Russians and the Chinese have known that they can't really compete in satellite technology with the West, so what they've got is things that shoot down satellites.
What about this new technology that Putin has announced, these nuclear-powered cruise missiles? What are they, a game-changer?
They are a game-changer, and that's another reason. The thing about the state-run arms industry in both China and Russia is that they decide what they want to produce and then they produce it. What you've got in the West is these various lobbies pushing for their stuff to be produced. So you've got all these people, the port and down people want chemical warfare, the Navy want more aircraft carriers, even though aircraft carriers are finished. Well, the Russians have concentrated on the important stuff is, if you attack us with any nuclear weapons or any of our allies, this is the important thing that Putin said, that we will nuke you. And we won't just nuke you a bit, we will nuke you. We will kill you all if you attack us.
So what's Theresa May's role in all this sort of rush to war?
She is basically a puppet of the intelligence services. She was a puppet of the intelligence services when she was Home Secretary. She's very much an insider in their games, and they tell her what to think, and that's what she thinks.
Well, thanks very much, Tony, for allowing me to use that. I think a great presentation, a bit of investigative reporting that you had there with Martin Summers. Thanks very much for that, and thanks for joining us now on the show. And you've said since then that there are various things that you'd like to share with us, various developments. You said to me in a text message, particularly about this guy who recruited Sergei Skripal to sell Russian secrets, a man called Pablo Miller, and the fact that both Skripal and Miller have links to this chap called Christopher Steele, the company Orbis Intelligence. Of course, people will know that name because of Steele being the source for this famous Trump-Russia dossier. I'm interested to know what you think the connections are here between these various people and, you know, what the significance of all that is.
Well, look, before I answer that one, Julian, I'd just like to say something about the fact that people are talking about this story all over the country, in the pubs, in the supermarket cafes, and none of those sorts of conversations are making their way onto our television screens, into our radio stations, or occasionally, I mean, maybe the odd phone-in, and that's a very important way to get these things discussed. Actually, there is no proper journalism going on this story whatsoever. What's happened is the opposite, really, which is lies and disinformation which haven't been checked against reality, which have been fed to journalists, presumably by Ministry of Defence press officers, police press officers, Cabinet Office press officers, and then just regurgitated as fact, are being reported as fact with no checking of any of these facts by the journalists. So not only are they not asking questions in their own minds, but they're not going to the actual source, supposed source of the story, and checking. So just for one example, there was a report that scores of people in Salisbury had also been subject to this nerve agent, and that they'd gone into Salisbury District Hospital or surgeries and been treated for nerve agent. Now, this was proven by the emergency medicine doctors at Salisbury District Hospital to be a lie. He actually wrote to, I think it was the Telegraph or the Guardian, saying nobody apart from these three people had been treated at all for any kind of nerve agent. So you just beg a belief that when you're reading something in the newspaper that tells you something about this story, particularly because it's highly politically charged, that it may be just complete nonsense and lies. You know the old phrase, fake news. It says more almost about the state of our press in Britain, this Novichok Salisbury story, than it does about the story itself. It's almost like the story kind of dissolves as you see another thing, and you think to yourself, well, this sounds like nonsense.
And it's interesting, though, that John Pilger described it as carefully crafted. You're saying it's not carefully crafted at all?
No, I think it's almost like on the back of an envelope, lies. I worked for the BBC between 1992, 93, into 94, I think it was roughly around those years, for about 18 months in Salisbury as a reporter for the BBC in Salisbury, for working for what they called the Salisbury opt-out on Wiltshire Sound, which was the BBC station for Wiltshire. It still is. I mean, it's called something else like BBC Wiltshire now. But we had an office in Salisbury, and I was working in there almost every day. So the area itself, it's about as military as it's possible to get, for a start. The main UK military training area for all sorts of types of forces, including things like the fleet air arm, you know, aircraft using it as a bombing practice, liaison with the ground, for example, what they probably call close air support, something like that, you know, where aircraft are supporting troops on the ground. All that was being done on Salisbury Plain, which is this massive part of Wiltshire right next to Salisbury, extremely militarised up. Yep. There's whole areas around Bulford and Tidworth which are totally and utterly military, quite large areas which are totally fenced off, you can't go into. So Wiltshire is about as militarised up as it's possible to be, with Salisbury Plain dominating the county. You know, it's actually quite nice. If anyone lives around there, you can go there Easter and Christmas time and over the New Year, and you're actually allowed to drive through. If you see any red flags, turn back.
You can almost not avoid bumping into Porton Down as well, can you? How many miles away is that from Salisbury?
Well, it's very close, yeah. Porton Down is very close. Mm. But let me just finish what I was saying. There is actually a church in the abandoned village of Imber, which you can go and see at Easter and Christmas, which is actually an amazing sight. It's a village which is now pretty much gone, apart from the village pub, which is used as part of training by the military. And the church is fenced off, and it's the only kind of thing left there, really, of the village. There has been a campaign for many years to get people to have their land back, because they were booted out in the Second World War. Anyway, I'd suggest, for wildlife and all sorts of things, Salisbury Plain is a wonderful place to go, and it is actually quite accessible, particularly around the periphery. But there's also, as you say, Porton Down, but not just that, which is the Chemical Biological Weapons Centre. You've also got Boscombe Down, which is the military's super long runway, the RAF's testing station, which is where they developed the bouncing bomb, for example, in the Second World War. There's the Land Warfare Centre at Wilton, which is just a couple of miles west of Salisbury, and then you've got something I discovered, which I don't know if it's supposed to be public, but certainly it was well known to us, underground nuclear weapons stores, various places dotted around there, where the stone came from to build Salisbury Cathedral. They dug the stone out and they found a massive kind of stone quarry there under the ground, and they were using that to store nukes and various other highly toxic stuff. Anyway, Salisbury looks like a lovely little kind of touristy town with its beautiful cathedral and spire, but actually everywhere you go is military, almost everywhere. When we talk about Porton Down, that's very close by. It's 10 minutes drive from Salisbury. And I can remember when I was working there, they had a place, they just closed it, early 90s, which was the Common Cold Research Centre, trying viruses out on people there. And so there was a positive aspect to it, because they were finding out about the common cold, but there was also the link between there and Porton Down, because they were very closely linked, that and the Common Cold Research Centre. And there were lots and lots of military who were basically used as guinea pigs horrendously by giving them about £10 a week extra in the 1950s and 1960s. Many of them were on national service, you know, so they didn't have any choices whether to be in the military. And back in 2000, there was the inquiry launched into 45 deaths. So we're talking about 45 servicemen, that's Royal Marines and Army mostly, who volunteered for Porton Down testing, told it was all safe, all above board, blah, blah, and then died as a result.
They tested sarin on them, didn't they?
They tested all sorts of things. I mean, they still haven't said all the different things they tested on them. I've spoken personally to one guy who, he was being tested in one of these kind of nuclear chemical biological suits, you know, gas mask and everything, and they encountered some kind of substance which made all the soldiers start laughing their heads off, and they tore off the suits because they were uncontrollable giggles. And of course that would then expose them much more than anything that was out there. No, this is total, they were guinea pigs, Julian. Appalling way to treat people. And then in 2008, I think a paltry sum of £3 million was issued as compensation. So anyway, there was a lot of courageous people that took, and actually BBC Points West here in Bristol was quite influential in getting that into the public eye and getting the courts to take that whole business seriously. So look, at the end of the day, the question is, can you trust Porton Down? The answer no. You can't.
No, I mean, I have no love for Porton Down, because I was brought up in Swanage on the south coast. And as listeners will know, Porton Down was involved in the spraying of live bacteria out in the coast there, out in the bay. And, you know, when I was a child, I had frequent chest infections. And of course, I don't know if there's any connection there, but I do wonder if that is in fact connected to what they were doing.
Well, it could well be, couldn't it? It's also very interesting that there's been really hardly any mention of Porton Down being nearby and being a potential source for this nerve agent in the reporting, which to me is just laughable, really. It's the most obvious potential reason. And I actually spoke to a former army officer today who worked at Porton Down as part of his job. He's an army officer, and he said, oh yes, they definitely had Novichok there.
Really?
The interesting things about the story, I mean, the nerve agents, they kill people very, very quickly, efficiently, very effectively. They're extremely dangerous substances. Even just a tiny droplet of this stuff on you can kill you, which begs the question, well, we got three people who weren't killed by this. I mean, if the Russian state was behind this and they wanted to kill any of these people, they would be dead. So something's gone wrong somewhere, or else the story doesn't stack up.
Did you pick up on the story of a medical professional who gave assistance to them and who was not hurt in any way, but the policeman was? That doesn't seem to add up at all. Did you come across that?
It doesn't make any sense, does it? No. One of the first things I heard from some colleagues in Salisbury was that they were extremely surprised that a detective sergeant was the first person on the scene. I mean, normally the first person on the scene would be a PC, and the detective sergeant would only get involved at a much later stage once an investigation had been launched, possibly potential charges had been gotten ready, arrest warrants prepared, that sort of thing. The detectives get involved. This is the CID, which the DS detective sergeant was, a much later stage, not certainly not the first person on the scene, so that's immediately suspicious. The other thing is the timing with the Russian election just a couple of weeks afterwards. Was the story designed to interfere with the Russian election? We've been making a lot of fuss about the Russians interfering in our elections without a lot of evidence, has to say. So maybe we're accusing them of what we're doing through operations like this. I mean, you started by asking about the whole Pablo Miller, Jonathan Steele, Orbis intelligence business, and that does look definitely looks suspicious. Obviously, this Sergei Skripal most definitely would still, you know, I would suggest still have a grudge against Russia and against the Russians, having obviously taken the Queen's shilling and betrayed his country and being ridiculed by his country, even though he was involved in a spy swap. He certainly wasn't very well respected there. So he, you know, may well have had a grudge against the Russians. And so we'd been quite willing to take part in any kind of psychological operation against Russia. So certainly that fits potentially. But, you know, the idea that he's working with these private company, which is basically an MI6 front, it seems, from Jonathan Steele, who wrote the Trump dossier. I've even had someone suggest to me that maybe Trump did it as a way to get back at Jonathan Steele for writing this document. I mean, you know, it's quite clearly MI6's fingerprints all over this. And we know MI6 are designed to kill, designed to lie. That's what they do. The only trouble is, they seem to be using some of their MI6 tactics, their James Bond techniques, against the British public, against British politicians. That's the target for this. And against British lawmakers, you know, against all officials in Britain. This is, I think, as a way of bending their minds to hate Russia more, because there's so many holes in this story. A rush to judgment. That's, I think, for me, in a way, the biggest hole of all was, oh, we've decided who did it. Literally, in 12 hours after it's happened, we've decided what happened. We decided who did it. We decided why. Look, you can't, you cannot, any, no sensible person can make, number one, a actual decision, and number two, then a whole load of diplomatic expulsion acts based on that decision when you haven't even got the facts and the evidence together. So this is definitely a rush to judgment. And I think one of the best commentators on all of it has been the former Uzbekistan ambassador, Craig Murray.
That's very interesting.
Who's pointed out it's of this Novichok nerve agent is of a type developed by Russia. Well, that doesn't mean anything. And as we've just heard, you know, I think there's something like 13 countries, including South Africa, that have developed this stuff and had files of it. Then we hear stories about a woman with a red suitcase disappearing up an alleyway just after the couple were discovered.
Just to go back to that of a type developed by Russia, that was quite an important point, wasn't it, that Craig Murray was making there, that this was a sort of compromise phrase that Portendown, he says anyway, that Portendown agreed to, because they couldn't actually pin this on Russia, but they were sort of arm-twisted into accepting a phrase that now has been repeated all over the place, isn't it? I mean, everywhere you listen, that is the phrase that's coming out.
Well, it may even be true that the Russians developed this.
Absolutely.
But that does not mean that it was actually administered by them, especially since we know, actually, I mean, the most obvious source for this is 10 minutes down the road, Julian.
Yes, yes. Yes, I mean, I wasn't saying that it's necessarily not true, but what I'm saying, and I think this is what Craig Murray was implying, was that this phrase is being used as a way of saying only Russia could do it. It doesn't mean that, but that's the way it's being employed as a phrase.
Yes, that's right. It's all psychological, isn't it? Also, I think the media coverage of it. I mean, there's one or two really appalling things. I mean, basically, Jeremy Corbyn is saying, look, let's just abide by the international regulations, by the rule of law. Let's just do this by the book. And as a result, the picture of him appears on Newsnight with a Photoshop cap looking very Russian with the Kremlin in the background. And it's really an attempt to fit him up as a Russian agent. Now, this is exactly what the establishment did to Harold Wilson in the 1970s. And this is what they do to people who are actually trying to abide by the law and do what ordinary British people want.
Yes, I find it very interesting that it was, I'm not sure when it was probably a couple of years ago or so, wasn't it? It was said, wasn't it, by somebody in the military, high up in the military, was saying that if Jeremy Corbyn ever comes to power, you know, the military would rebel against that.
Well, they're saying he wouldn't pass vetting as well.
Right, right. So, yes. So in connection with this, I'm just wondering whether you think what happened a few weeks back when there was this business of him, of Jeremy Corbyn having had connections with a Czech communist spy, whether that is actually part of this operation that's going on here, because there's been a link back to that in the news, hasn't there? Ah, you know, you can see that there are these connections to, you know, the Cold War, communism back in those days. Look, it's all connected up here. He won't blame Russia, etc.
Yes, of course. I mean, you know, I think what's going on here is we've got these military psychological warfare units. The most obvious one is the place that trains psychological warfare officers in Chicksands in Bedfordshire. But now we've got this thing which was announced about 3 or 4 years ago called Brigade 77, which I wonder whether it's anything to do with the 7/7 bombings that they've called it that. Who knows? I mean, this is sort of a joke that they like to do. But this is a psychological warfare unit. Now, I wonder whether these sorts of units are being used, and maybe it's just people who have been worked there and trained there and are now employed in the private sector, are being used to cook these sorts of stories up. I think they realise that there's nobody in Britain who is going to stop the British military or private businesses like Bell Pottinger, for example. And it's just an example. Bell Pottinger, it was a London-based firm which was taking money from the Pentagon to manufacture fake Al-Qaeda videos and then get them shown on the British TV. This is the sort of thing I think we might be witnessing here, is the same kind of process where the military are funding private companies to cook up a whole sort of propaganda narratives to then be fed to the British people. Because the thing is, as they've run out of options on foreign policy internationally, they've been blocked in Syria and Ukraine by Russia, been blocked by China elsewhere. They're thinking, well, look, we might as well use these against our own people. At least we can, you know, bamboozle them into, you know, coming up with kind of foreign policy results we want. Look, one really
Can I just say, are you actually suggesting there that this? Well, I just wanted, before you go on to the next thing about it, are you actually suggesting here that the whole Skripal affair is kind of made up?
Well, it could be a drama. It could be a drama we're watching here. Mm. I haven't seen any evidence of these. I mean, when we had Alexander Litvinenko in hospital, we kept having photographs of him on the front page of the papers every day when he was poisoned. Incidentally, that was all to do with Boris Berezovsky in Russia too. And I think Litvinenko was poisoned because he was starting to realise that there was a much bigger game going on. He wrote a book, Blowing Up Russia, about Berezovsky and Putin getting together to blow up housing blocks in Moscow in order to blame it on the Chechens and get the Chechen war started. Well, what happened was Berezovsky decided that Putin was kind of wrapped up in this, and therefore if he ever needed to get rid of Putin, he could just threaten him with saying, look, I'm going to expose your role in these bombings. He thought that Putin would be his little puppet as a prime minister and then as a president. Anyway, so then he became president after Yeltsin. And Putin basically turned the tables on him by going to the chief prosecutor's office and saying, look, there's some old charges we've got on Berezovsky to do with the privatization of Aeroflot. And that's the guy that's just died in London. He was the finance manager for Aeroflot. So the Aeroflot case was reinstituted by Putin. And that meant that Berezovsky had to go in and testify. He had two Swiss companies that had been involved in asset stripping Aeroflot. And this is how people like Berezovsky made all their money, these oligarchs, by just asset stripping the whole country like they've done here in the West. So long story short, Berezovsky was phoned by Putin. And he said, look, just to let you know, because you're a mate, I'll let you know this. In 24 hours, the police are going to come and arrest you and charge you over this Aeroflot business and various other things where you've stolen government assets. I'm just doing this as a favour to you to let you know. It's probably a good idea if you get out of the country tonight. You know, so Berezovsky did. He flew to London. And that was it. Berezovsky's then tried to use this whole business of the Moscow Ryazan bombings in 1999 to blackmail Putin. But the West doesn't want him to do that, as Martin explained. But this background, I think, is important. If you look at the way that Litvinenko story ran out, there was pictures all the time. Now, why haven't we seen pictures of these ill people in the hospital? I think we need a bit more evidence that what we're being told happened actually happened. But anyway, the point I was trying to get onto was about who is behind the policy of escalating tension with Russia. Who is behind it? It doesn't seem to be in the British national interest at all, because a nuclear war with Russia would lead to the deaths of millions of British people. So whose interest is it in? Difficult. I mean, maybe the US sees Britain as expendable. Obviously, they, so long as they can still fly jet planes off of Britain and store nuclear bombs here, they don't really care what happens to the rest of the country. So it could well be the Pentagon. The other thing, of course, is the Israelis as well are very annoyed about the way that the Russians have blocked them in the Middle East. And, of course, MI6 too, are very close to both of those two. But the people who are really pushing this are called the Royal Institute for International Affairs. That's Chatham House in London, which is just close to Prince Charles's palace, St. James's Palace, just off Piccadilly. These are the guys that have been doing all the analysis that says Russia did it, leading the way. And I can tell you, when I was at the BBC in London, we were told all the time, whenever there was some sort of international crisis or whatever, oh, ask Chatham House. Chatham House is completely funded by the corporates. I mean, that is to say the banks, the hedge funds, car manufacturers, big media. This is a private think tank. that is actually now setting our foreign policy. We've got an equivalent in the US, which is called the Council on Foreign Relations. These two institutions, the CFR in the US and the RIIA, or Chatham House, also it's nicknamed, in London, are actually driving all of this. And that is simply because those institutions, the funders of those institutions, see Russia as a threat to their expansionist policies, what in Ukraine, in the Black Sea, and in the Eastern Mediterranean, which is key to controlling the the Middle East.
So would that observation fit with what Finian Cunningham wrote a week ago or so about this could be opposition to the Nord Stream gas line? You know, many in the US and the EU consider the gas line would give Moscow too much power over Europe, so they want that to fail.
They're just trying to block the Russians in. They're trying to just completely deny the rest of the world to the Russians. Let's not make no bones about it. When we had MH17 airliner go down in Ukraine a few years ago, that was when the European Union introduced sanctions. There was, again, no proper evidence that the Russians had done that. But then they decided they're going to institute sanctions. Just a few weeks ago, the Americans put sanctions on, I think it was 50 different major firms in China that have been trading with North Korea in one way or another. Now, these are acts of war, Julian. Sanctions are economic warfare. What they're doing is they're signalling very clearly to the Russians, is to say, we'd like to fight you, but not yet, maybe in a few months' time. And if you don't do as we say, we're going to put more and more sanctions. We're going to isolate you even more. We won't trade with you. And it has a negative effect on their national economic prospects and investment and that sort of thing. So it's just another form of warfare, just as this psychological warfare is. And in fact, the Saker, who's a very good international analyst, his website is called vineyardsaker.is. He is a former UN military analyst who was booted out because he kept telling people things they didn't want to hear, a bit like maybe me at the BBC. His analysis of this is that modern warfare is, I think it was 80% psychological warfare. That is to say, bamboozling the public, bending their minds, lying to them, conning them. And not just the public, of course, it's politicians. People are like sheep. They just go along. You know, the politicians don't want to stick their neck out. They want to make sure that they're going to be back in another term. They don't want to say something which is going to attract the attention of the major newspapers pillorying them. So 80% psychological warfare using the mainstream media, the corporate media mainly, and 15% economic warfare, and only 5% is actually fighting. So I think the modern major war, what we'd see is much more propaganda, much more economic warfare, which of course was happening between the wars on Germany, really to punish Germany for the First World War, when we know where that led. And the actual fighting will be very, very sharp and quick. So if the Russians decide, as they threaten to do, to retaliate against the United States for any attack on their troops in Syria, which is effectively Russian, I mean, don't even think of trying to take hold of Syria. It's Russian territory. They need it in order to survive. So if you try and take Syria away from Russia, what you're saying is we want Russia to die. That's why the Russians have really stuck with Assad, because they know they need it. And when that happens, that will be so fast, Julian. It will be very, very quick. We'll be wham, bam, thank you, ma'am. We might see military bases across Norfolk, for example, hit with Russian weapons, not necessarily nuclear initially, but quite possibly various things destroyed, like aircraft hangars, control towers with precision-guided weapons. The first, I would suggest, would be US bases in Britain. They would be places like Menwith Hill. And then we might well see British bases being hit if the British decided to go along with an American assault on Russia. So that's really what we're looking at. And I think it would be very, very fast.
But would it escalate immediately to the nuclear dimension?
Not necessarily, no. But I think we're actually moving towards that. Now we've got the US and the Russians squaring up against each other in Syria. We've got immense pressure being put on Trump by the Israel lobby to basically do what they want in the Middle East. And we've had that here in the UK as well, tremendous pressure. And a great deal of power of the Israel lobby in the British media. One thing you can say to prove that is how little real historical criticism there's been of the whole Zionist project in the press and the media here.
No, no, no. You're not allowed to criticise political Israel at all, are you? I mean, this is another thing that Craig Murray talks about. He said that Israel was a possibility in this equation, and a lot of people have attacked him as being an anti-Semite just because he said that. But I mean, it's a possibility. Just logically speaking, it's a possibility.
Yes, it is. And there is a very basic, Glenn Greenwald very brilliantly, I think, pointed this out. He said, look, if you try and fight Israel, you're a terrorist. And if you try and you want to do it peacefully, through peaceful means, you're an anti-Semite. Whatever happens, you will shut up, you will agree. Now, this is actually a very totalitarian attitude that's been promulgated and actually been supported for quite a while within the senior ranks of the Labour Party. I hope that's all come to an end now.
Going back to Chatham House, I noticed in a reproduction of one of their articles on your forum that the reasons they give, the motives they give for Putin having done this, are extremely weak. They say things like, because he can, sort of flexing his muscles kind of thing, that he's trying to test the UK because the Russians think that the UK is weak. And I think, what kind of reason is that for doing such a thing? It makes no sense at all.
Along with the rush to judgment, this total lack of motive is another massive flaw in this story. Mm. Anybody, chatting about this down the pub tonight is thinking these things. The incredible thing is that the mainstream press is not allowing those things to be talked about. What we've ended up with is we've got a mainstream press which has now become literally the spearhead of the war machine. There was a comment which was sent to me. It was written originally, I think, by the Russian ambassador to the UK, literally just a few days ago, and it was sent to me by a guy called Scott Bennett. He's a very interesting bloke to track down. He's a former US Army psychological warfare officer. He worked at the Rand Corporation designing the Arab Spring. So that's where, if you wanted to know where the Arab Spring came from, it was something called the Rand Corporation invented it. He called it a Rand Corporation product. And the idea was to sort of ferment things and stir things up so that they could be rearranged and put back in a different order, which is the way that US foreign policy wanted. And that's, of course, what happened. Anyway, one of the things he says the Russian ambassador to the UK gave an interview to Russia Today's Anastasia Cherkina about the chemical poisoning of a former Russian spy and allegations being made by PM Theresa May against Russia and Putin. So, number one thing to say is all of the press and all of the British cabinet and government have done a really basic mistake. That is to conflate speculation with fact. Now, what that makes them is, guess what? They're all conspiracies. Okay?
Totally right.
Anyway, what he says in this, excellent intellectual Russian ambassador, he says the blowback from this will be a separation of the thinking people from the mindless idiots in society and an increase in social distrust and hostility towards politicians and media and government institutions. This is fermenting instability and the destruction of personal civil liberties through manufactured national hysteria. Essentially, he says, they've cried wolf far too many times to be given any respect by intelligent citizens. Now, to me, that just sums it up. It links back to Chatham House being the origin of this kind of policy move. This is big business wanting to break up society, to fragment society, destroy government. Effectively, you're talking about a kind of anarcho-capitalist, nihilistic force which sees money and the pursuit of wealth and power as the only thing they're interested in as a way of just destroying all opposition. That is including within the governments. Not only are they actually physically destroying the government by the power and the immense amount of wealth that they're accruing whilst the government is being starved of that wealth and they're not being taxed properly, they're actually also just smashing the morale of those involved in those kind of democratic and government institutions. So that suits the book of the big financial corporates and those who are funding Chatham House. So that's what I'm saying is those institutions, I think, really are at the bottom of what's going on. It's simply private power saying democracy can go hang as far as we're concerned. We're just going to do what we want.
Yeah, this psychological operation angle has revealed itself to me in a number of ways during this affair. And one is with this explanation that the only plausible conclusion is that Russia did it, or that Russia lost control of its stocks and so is culpable one way or the other. They don't say it's the only possible explanation. They don't say it's the only feasible explanation. They say it's the only plausible explanation. And that makes me wonder whether, you know, what's being said there is that there's a certain sphere of discourse, there's a certain way of thinking outside of which you're not allowed to go. There's a plausibility structure, which is that the West and its allies wouldn't ever be involved in anything like that. You're not allowed to think outside that particular box.
Yeah, it's just as deeply insulting as it was in Nazi Germany to circulate the lies about the Jews being behind everything. It's just deeply insulting. It's totally disgusting. The other thing we haven't mentioned is just how strangely similar this all is to weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. That was proved to be total rubbish.
Yes.
I think what we're dealing with here is really a criminal elite who have got no interest in the lives of ordinary people here. They have just interest in their own survival, because they realise that if we get a reinstituted system of democratic government, potentially through, you know, people like Jeremy Corbyn, his ilk, rather than the Blairites in the Labour Party actually managing to take power and start to change things in this country, that many of these people are going to be on trial. Many of them are going to be going to jail for long periods of time. Many of them reputations will be destroyed and ruined. That's why I think these people are taking such, I think, ridiculous and extreme measures, insulting measures against the intellects of tens of millions of British people in order to get what they want, and that they're prepared to be so utterly brazen about it. I mean, Boris Johnson, David Cameron, Nathaniel Rothschild, Jonathan Ford, the leader writer for the Times, George Osborne, all these people were in a little club in Oxford called the Bullingdon Club, where they were told, you guys will be running the show. So what's happened is they've got all these people, loads of these people who are now in positions of power, or have been recently and probably still are to a certain extent, and they've said to them in their teens, look, guys, let's just kind of, you know, really get to know it. So their loyalty is not to us. It's to their cult, their little club. And that's why we have the problems that we've got, is because we're in the hands of a cultish kind of criminal.
And they clearly think that we're all stupid. This is one of the things I constantly think as I'm listening to the news. I think, how stupid do you think we really are to believe this? Because it's so preposterous.
Well, some people don't necessarily realise what's happening. That's the trouble, I suppose. It's a very good way of dividing society, isn't it? And what does the devil do? The devil's the divider. The Freemasons, you know, the dividers and the rule, you know, the square. And this is exactly what, you know, the British Empire and the British ruling class have been doing for centuries, dividing and ruling.
You mentioned the weapons of mass destruction element there, and that reminded me of the simple fact that choosing chemical weapons as a means to carrying this out is something that Putin, I'm quite sure, would certainly not have done, because it feeds exactly into the narrative we've had about Assad using chemical weapons. It's absolutely absurd that he would do it that way. If he was going to kill that guy off, he would have done it with a pellet, a heart attack pellet or something. The kind of thing that was talked about in the 1970s that the CIA had. I'm sure the Russians have that as well. They would have done it quietly, wouldn't they? Got rid of him.
I'm sure there's lots of different ways.
Yeah, exactly.
People. But look, Russians destroyed all their chemical weapons about 18 months ago, and there was a big ceremony, and they don't have any chemical weapons. At least that's what we're being told, and yet we're also being told they do. So,
yeah, but even if they did, is there any way that you could imagine that Putin would do that and feed into that narrative against his own interests?
Yeah, there is one positive side of all of this, and I think it shows that the ruling class in Britain, in London, saying it's not really Britain, is it? It's just London. They've really lost it. They really do think that people will believe this rubbish. And they think that if, I mean, George Orwell, didn't he, resigned from the BBC in, I think, 1942, saying that the propaganda doesn't work. Because he's right, in a way. The more you try and force lies down people's throats through propaganda, the less people will believe you. Okay, so it has this effect of fracturing society, dividing society into the credulous and the intelligent, with the credulous supposedly having all the kudos and the intelligent being the conspiracy theorists or whatever. You know, really is a very, very, you know, it's topsy-turvy. So it puts the idiots in charge, and the intelligentsia, the most intelligent, are somehow kind of ground down to nothing as not valuable people. I mean, the effect of this is ultimately going to be, I think, the end of this Tory government. I don't think they can carry on with this kind of tactic and be taken seriously, and certainly not get elected. It would be interesting to see actually how they get on in these forthcoming local elections, particularly in London. I think they're just going to—they're going to be absolutely massackered. We'll see. But I mean,
well, it will be interesting, because some people have been suggesting that Theresa May is going to benefit from this.
And with Grenfell Tower too, which is absolutely disgusting, the way that the Tory government and the Tory council dealt with that, Kensington and Chelsea, still not a single arrest after all this time.
I wonder how many people were shocked to hear about Gavin Williamson announcing this £48 million extra for the Chemical Weapons Defence Centre. And
you know what? That sounds exactly to me like a bribe.
Yeah, exactly. I thought the same thing. Yes,
this is just a bung. I mean, Martin was wondering whether it was organised beforehand. I don't think so. I think it was organised on the hoof. They're not playing ball. Oh, let's just chuck them some money. This is effectively a kind of gangster state we're living in at the moment, Julian, where they're behaving like gangsters. You know, let's just use a bit of this trough of money we've got here from the poor people, because, of course, the rich are almost all avoiding tax. The real winners are the super rich. The poor are just being completely destroyed under this government. And I don't think actually the British people are going to stand for it much longer.
And today we've had Boris Johnson liken Putin to Hitler, echoing Hillary Clinton's remarks. Yeah. Go on.
Prince Charles did that a few years ago, and I just called about it, saying Charles strikes another blow for the British Republic. You know, this guy, Johnson, and Prince Charles are very close, aren't they? They're supposed to be, you know, this elite, they really do see themselves as better, which is disturbing to think that people like that could be in power. I think, hopefully, their days are numbered, this lot. I think we're going to see, particularly with the rise of Prince William and Harry, and the possible bypassing of Prince Charles, because he wouldn't be a popular head of state. He's just said so many ridiculous things. He's just fixing laws. So if a law affects him he doesn't like the Freedom of Information Act, he then just tweaks it and changes it, and I'm not going to sign that law, and we'll just change that one before it goes. I mean, this really doesn't go down well, so he's not going to be a popular head of state. I think that there is a kind of new generation coming forward. It's just about time we got these old fossils out of the way.
Right. Well, I suppose the last thing I want to ask you is whether you think Putin is right when he thinks there are going to be more false flags coming down the line. And he was saying that a while ago with respect to Damascus. But I'm wondering whether you think there are going to be, you know, more false flags directed at Russia coming
down
the line.
There's hard evidence for this. They've shown that there are chemical attacks being prepared in Syria. And they've actually come out with this news beforehand. So the idea is to actually stop that coming out. Now, of course, this it shows the importance of channels like Russia Today, and yes, why it's rather, I mean, you know, people forget about Press TV, which I do reports on quite regularly, and that's the Iranian channel from Tehran, and that was banned. We need to have all these things. Look, go back to the Second World War.
Yeah, well, before you say that, I agree with you. I mean, each of these channels has its own propagandistic angle, but I think it's important to have that variety to look at so that you can make the decision for yourself. That's what I think a lot of people don't, that doesn't come into the conversation. They think, oh, well, of course it's Russian propaganda. Well, yeah, of course it is, but that's important in its own right.
BBC is British propaganda. It's far worse, actually. I mean, okay, so I criticised Putin on Russia Today, and I found that when the YouTube clip went up, that bit had been cut out of the YouTube. You know, that sort of thing happens. Mm-hmm. That's just kind of normal, really, with a state broadcaster.
Yes.
You know, if I was to have a pop at the Queen, you might find on the BBC that when that went up on YouTube, that might be... Anyway, I mean, the BBC actually used to be much more balanced up until 1987 and the sacking of Alistair Milne, whose son is now the Director of Communications for Jeremy Corbyn. And he was sacked by Thatcher and by Victor Rothschild, effectively by the city. Victor Rothschild, in Peter Wright's book, Spycatcher, he makes it clear Rothschild was selecting the new Director General of MI5 and MI6. One of those things that happened in the 1980s, and I kind of didn't read it at the time, but I read it in about around the late 90s. Fascinating insight. But when it comes to press around the world, go back to the Second World War. All the way through that, Radio Luxembourg was blasting out Lord Haw Haw. He's a very British lord, and he was broadcasting all this kind of ridicule of the British establishment from the point of view of Nazi Germany as a Nazi propaganda station. Churchill and his bods were scratching their heads in London, saying, well, we could jam this, sir, you know. And the attitude was, no, we want everyone to hear it. And if we jam it, people will think, well, wonder what they're saying. You know, this was a sophisticated approach, and it's a confident approach, which was taken in the Second World War. What they did is they had shows on the BBC which were ridiculing Lord Haw Haw, and they had genuine criticism of it. So they reacted to it, but they reacted in a very mature and sensible way. So people could listen to Lord Haw-Haw if they wanted to, but then, you know, they knew that they were being fed Russian, they were being fed Nazi propaganda. Now the opposite is true. It's like we are the Nazis. We are trying to feed propaganda around the world, and we're not prepared to listen to points of view of other countries. Now that inevitably is going to lead to war unless we have some really serious political change in this country.
Before you go, I just want to ask you if you know much about Gavin Williamson, because I find him the most implausible person, and he's just such a yes man all the time. It's incredible.
He seems, should we just say, shallow. When we were at the BBC, they made a big play of you've got to be authoritative. Well, there's nothing authoritative about him. He just seems like he's playing at being Defence Secretary. God only knows who decided that he'd make a good Defence Secretary. I don't think if he was in any kind of combat situation that he'd be the one that all of the hardened soldiers would turn to for advice. And yet he's at the head of the whole military establishment in the country. I mean,
is it just because he is a yes man? Is it because he thinks the right thoughts? And
he's a bunch of cowards and control freaks in charge. He's a pliable stooge. He will do as he's told. He will read from the script, and he will probably burble his lines. But at least he's a so-called safe pair of hands that will do what he's told. And I'm afraid that is the way that government starts. I mean, the thing is, remember, in the background, all the time, you've got big corporations who are growing in strength all the time as government is dying around us. And this means that they won't be regulated. They can do what they want. They can commit crimes with impunity. That's exactly the way these big, you know, powerful, rich directors want it.
Well, thanks very much, Tony, for spending all this time and just coming out with this avalanche of information, which you said you were going to do before we started talking here.
Thanks ever so much. Stay in touch, mate.
Thank you. It's very good of you. Go to sleep, mate. I'm struggling. Okay, thanks a lot.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, well, that is it for today. Well, not quite, actually. I'll explain in a minute. Thanks again to Tony for coming on like that at such short notice. Always fascinating to chat to Tony Gosling. Difficult sometimes to get a word in edgeways, though granted I was tired because he's always very keen to unload a mass of information. Very, very interesting, very worthwhile listening to and pondering. And my thanks also, of course, to Martin Summers for the earlier part of today's show. A very astute observer there of current events, so my thanks to him. And also to BCFM for permission to use that valuable segment from their politics show. So that is almost it, but I just want to add one thing before closing today's programme. There was something which Tony and I had intended to mention which got missed in the recorded conversation, probably because it was getting so late, but I shall add it now. On the forum that Tony runs, which I shall link to in the show notes, there's some discussion about a TV programme that's been going on for a while called Strike Back Retribution, which is apparently a 10-part UK-US action TV series that was first aired in the UK on 31st of October 2017 on Sky One. Now, very interestingly, episodes 4, 5 and 6, at least according to their Wikipedia page, make mention of, wait for it, the nerve agent Novichok in the plot description, something which, and I have to admit I'm guessing here, something which has not made a regular appearance on British or American TV over the years, and yet here with three episodes broadcast in the UK on the 21st and 28th of November last year, and then the 31st of January this year, and then even more peculiarly aired in the US on the 23rd of February, 2nd of March and 9th of March this year, thus overlapping with the event in Salisbury, we get mention of the very nerve agent claimed to have been used and prominent mentions of Russia. Coincidence? Well, possibly, but considering what we know from the work of people such as Tom Secker and Matthew Alford in their book National Security Cinema, who have documented the involvement of intelligence agencies in the entertainment industry, maybe not. Maybe we're looking here at predictive programming. Maybe somebody was priming us for this event, so that we would be much more likely to believe the story when it happened for real. I don't know, but I do find it suspicious. Anyway, that is now it for today. Thank you for your attention. You have been listening to me, Julian Charles, of themindrenewed.com, and I very much look forward to speaking to you again in the near future.